We're now beginning a study of the 35th Psalm. The title to this psalm states that it was written by David. We have no reason to think that it wasn't written by David, although there's nothing in the psalm itself that tells us this. And it is about some time in the writer's life in which he was undergoing a persecution. A persecution in which his former friends had now become his enemies. And we do not know just what the occasion was. Nothing is said in the psalm about that. But there's been a lot of speculation. Some have referred it to the time of the persecution of David by Saul. Others to the opposition which he encountered from Ahithophel or Shimei, or to the ingratitude of Mephibosheth, found in 2 Samuel 16, verse 3. Others have referred it to the rebellion of Absalom, and others have referred it to the Messiah as prophetically descriptive of what would occur to him. Now, there's nothing in the psalm that actually refers to the Messiah. There is one quotation in which David says, "They hated me without cause," and some seem to think that John 15:25, where it is said, "But this cometh to pass, that the word which might be fulfilled, which is written in their law, they hated me without a cause," that refers to this psalm. However, that quotation is a more literal quotation from Psalms 69, verse 4. There he says, "They hate me without a cause." And that psalm is undoubtedly one that refers to the Messiah. So there's been a lot of speculation as to what the specific circumstances were that caused David to write this psalm, and we do not know what those circumstances were, and it's not important that we know. But what we can know, what is apparent in this psalm, is that the central idea, that which makes it so useful, is that it was composed with reference to the treatment which the author had received from those who had been his professed friends, from those to whom he had shown kindnesses in their troubles, to whom he had been a friend and a brother, but who now had turned against him. In the times of prosperity, they had been his professed friends and had partaken freely and largely of his hospitality. When they were afflicted, he had shown them sympathy and kindness. But when he had problems, when he had hard times come upon him, they forsook him, and they joined with his persecutors. They joined with those who had falsely accused him, and they became then his enemies. The psalm, therefore, has a special applicability to trials of that nature. It expresses the feelings and the views of the author in regard to his own sorrows as springing from such ingratitude and his earnest prayer to God to interpose on his behalf. In this psalm, we see the rolling of the sorrows of his pained and oppressed heart upon the arm of his unchanging friend, the mighty and merciful God. Now, as occasions similar to those referred to in this psalm do occur, they occur quite commonly in the world, it seemed to have been important then that in the volume of inspiration, that in the Bible, an example should be furnished of the manner in which those that are righteous are to meet such a form of trial. The first 10 verses of this psalm are the recording of his prayer to God, calling upon God to give him deliverance, to realize what his situation is, and to defeat his enemies in their cause against him. So, beginning in verse 1 of this 35th psalm, "Plead my cause, O Lord, with them that strive against me. Fight against them that fight against me." So he's asking God here to act in the position of an attorney or a lawyer, or one that would be his advocate before a judge or a court of tribunal. This word for plead actually means to argue or to persuade. So he's asking God then to use his force of persuasion to argue or try to convince this court that he is innocent, that he is not guilty of the things that have been accused or charged against him. "Plead my cause, O Lord, with them that strive against me." Now, this word for strive there is the same as plead. In other words, there are others that are pleading against him, that are using their argument, that are using their force or persuasion against him in this same court. It's as though David is on trial. One group is trying to accuse him of being guilty of something, and he's asking God to take his side, take his cause, and to defend him against them that strive against him. So plead with them that strive against me. So God is here asked to step in between David and his enemies to act as a one that's going to be in the defense of David. He's pleading or arguing David's case against those that are then trying to oppose David. He says, fight against them that fight against me. Whatever they're doing against me, God, you step in and you take my side. You take my cause. You fight against them. You be my protector and my defender. Fight against them that fight against me. Now, what a wonderful thing it is for us to be able to go to God in this way. Whatever or whoever our enemy, foe, may be, however great, however small, to be able to ask God to step in and to take over the fight, to fight for us, to fight against them that fight against me. This is a very wonderful situation to be in, to have a God like this and to be able to approach God on these terms. And that's what David is doing here. It's not a matter of our being able to show that we're all so powerful and that we're able to do all of our own defense and that we can overcome anything that comes along our way. It's a matter of being able to have God to do this. And actually, God is the one who does get vengeance. If there's any vengeance to be gotten, if there's any thing that deserves to be done in that way, God does it. It's not our place to do it. In the second verse, he says, take hold of shield and buckler and stand up for mine help. Now, he's further asking God to enter the fight in his favor, to enter the fight to go against those that are going against him. And he tells him to take hold of shield and buckler. These are weapons of warfare. A shield is an instrument that's used to defend yourself with. And a buckler is also a shield. It's a rounded shield. So to enter into this fight, God needed weapons. And David is here telling him to take hold of shield and buckler. These are defensive weapons. Stand up for mine help. Whatever the enemy will have to throw against me, use against me, be prepared to defend me against their attack. Then he says in verse 3, draw out also the spear. Now the spear was another weapon of warfare, but it's not a defensive weapon, it's an offensive weapon. To draw out means to draw it out from its place of keeping, or it may even mean to draw it out so that it can be prepared to be thrown in an offensive way. But the spears were usually made as long as possible so that they could still be effectively used, and they were an offensive weapon. So he's telling the Lord to get the defensive weapons, the shield and buckler, and then also draw out this offensive weapon, the spear. Draw out also the spear, and stop the way against them that persecute me. So the Lord, not only in our defense, does he have defensive weapons so that he can neutralize the forces that come against us, but he also has offensive weapons so that he then will be able to bring about some kind of destruction of those that come against us. Stop the way against them. Now, the words here, the way, are not in the original, and this simply means to stop the passageway or to close off the path or the gate of those that would come against me, of those that persecute me. So he's going to put some kind of an obstacle in the way of those that are persecuting David. He's going to do something to either stop them or slow them down so that they're not going to be so effective in their crusade against the writer of this psalm. And he says in the end of verse 3, say unto my soul, I am thy salvation. That is, give me some assurance. Assure me that I'm going to be saved. Assure me that you're going to do these things. Say this unto my soul. And of course we know that the plan of salvation is arranged to give such assurance. All we have to do is to simply be acquainted with God's plan of salvation for us today, to know the things that God has put into motion, put into effect, for us to be able to have forgiveness, for us to be able to go to Him and be cleansed of our faults and our sins, and we can be then fully assured of God's protection. And so that's what he's crying for. And this is a plea that basically all mankind makes. Say unto my soul, I am thy salvation. We all want to be assured that we are saved or that we're going to be saved. We want to be assured that God is going to bring this about. And we ask God to tell us, give us some evidence, give us some kind of assurance. Say unto my soul, I am thy salvation. And we learn this. We get the answer to this need by simply studying the Word of God, knowing what He has said, knowing what His promises are, knowing what His covenant is with us, and then living up to our part of the bargain. God's going to keep His part if we'll just simply keep our part. And then we have the assurance that God is our salvation. And that's what David is crying for here. In verse 4 he says, "Let them be confounded and put to shame that seek after my soul. Let them be turned back and brought to confusion that devise my hurt." He's still talking about those that are his enemies, those that are trying to do him harm. And here he's suggesting ways in which God can thwart them. "Let them be confounded and put to shame that seek after my soul." To be confounded is another way of saying to be made ashamed or to be disappointed, to have some kind of confusion brought about so that their purpose will be not accomplished. "Let them be confounded and put to shame." That is, whatever they're trusting in, whatever they think that they have in the way of success, let them see failure. Let them be ashamed of their methods, of their present course of life. Let them see that they're wrong. But let them be confounded and put to shame that seek after my soul or seek after my life. They're out to get me. They're seeking after me. And so I'm depending upon you, God, to do something to thwart them, to do something to dissuade them, bring about some kind of a change so that they're not able to be successful. He further says, "Let them be turned back and brought to confusion that devise my hurt." So whatever methods they're using, I'm praying that you would cause their methods to be a failure. Let them be turned back. Let them not be successful. Let them be brought to this state of confusion, this state of not knowing which way to go because they have been unsuccessful, not having accomplished that which they are setting out to do. Those that devise my hurt. They're devising some way to bring about harm to me. This is what their desire is. This is what their actions are intended to bring about. Verse 5, he says, "Let them be as chaff before the wind." Now, he's giving some very deep and terrific images here of ways that he is asking God to come into his defense. The chaff, of course, is that part of the wheat which is the dust. It's the part that's not beneficial. And so as you throw the wheat up before the wind, the chaff then is blown away. It is not only is it not desirable, but it is blown away and is no more present even. It's separated from that which is good. So let them be as the chaff before the wind. Then he says, "And let the angel of the Lord chase them." Now, the angel of the Lord is one of the weapons or one of the messengers, one of the tools that God would use to bring about his will and to bring about his protection of David. So he asked God, "Let the angel of the Lord chase them. Use your mighty angel. Use the most effective thing that's available to be used and employ this and bring about my defense and chase my enemies." And he says further in verse 6, "Let their way be dark and slippery." For the way to be dark means that they would be groping along, not able to find the proper way. They can't see. They can't protect themselves from danger. They cannot alter their course if they're going into danger. They're walking a dark path. They are very muchly hindered by the fact that they're not able to see. So let the way be dark and slippery. Slippery further adds to the problem. Not only are they on a dark path, but they're on a path that's slippery. It's difficult for them to keep their footing. They're going to have a hard time not sliding down or not sliding into the ditch or maybe not sliding off of a deep cliff some way. So the imagery here is very striking. They're going to be walking a dark path. They're going to be walking a slippery path. And so not only can they not see, but they can't keep their footing properly. And then he further says to that, "And let the angel of the Lord persecute them." Now here again is the angel of the Lord, God's mighty weapon, coming in to do God's will. And we never know how many times God does use his angels in this regard. How many times an angel may be dispatched to our side to give us assistance. How many times an angel may be used to thwart the desires of those that are truly the enemies of God and the enemies of God's people. And this word for persecute doesn't really mean persecute. It means to pursue. Let the angel of the Lord pursue them. So here they are, the enemies of David, walking along a dark path, one in which they can't see the way. The path is also slippery, so that they have a difficult time even keeping their footing or keeping from sliding off into some danger. And then to complicate that with the fact that the angel of the Lord is pursuing them. This angel of the Lord is hastening to catch up to them to destroy them, and so they're having to flee down this dark, slippery path. That's the image that he gives here. And then he says in verse 7, "For without cause have they hid for me their net in a pit, which without cause they have digged for my soul." Now, another description of what they've done against him. They have dug this pit, and they hid a net in it, and it's designed to entrap David. David is liable to fall into this pit and be trapped and caught by them when he is the most unaware of it, most unsuspecting of it. And he says they've done this without cause. They've made some elaborate plans here to trap me. They're out after me, and they really don't have a cause. They're not justified in what they're doing. They've done it without cause, and they've dug this pit for my soul. That is for my life. So this is the reason I want you to interpose on my behalf, God. This is the reason I'm asking you to send your mighty angel. This is the reason I'm asking you to arm yourself and to stand in my way for defense and for the offense, to protect me, because they've done these things against me and there's no cause. I'm innocent. I have not done the things that they have accused me of doing. I am someone that's being persecuted for no good reason. And so he says in verse 8, "Let destruction come upon him at unawares, and let his net that he hath hid catch himself. Into that very destruction let him fall." This idea of destruction coming upon him at unawares means that it would come when he's not expecting it. That there would be ways and methods that God would use against his enemy, and his enemy would not be prepared for it. His enemy wouldn't be expecting it to happen. And this is, of course, the way God works many times. God brings about reverses in the plans of persons, and they're not expecting this to happen. They haven't anticipated this. They haven't built in any kind of a defense against it, and so then they are completely defeated. Time when he is not aware of it, not expecting it. "And let his net that he hath hid catch himself. Into that very destruction let him fall." And so what David is simply asking here is that whatever thing he's prepared for me, let that happen to him. Let him have happen to him what he wants to have happen to me. So whatever wickedness this person has devised, whatever punishment or whatever destruction he's devised, just let that happen to him. So let happen to him what he has desired to have happen to me. And that it seems to be a very appropriate thought also. What better punishment should someone have than to let them be punished with the very thing that they're designing to do to someone else? And he says in verse 9, "And my soul shall be joyful in the Lord." When you give me this deliverance, when you come to my aid, when you stand in the way and defend me against those that are my enemies, then my soul shall be joyful in the Lord. I'm going to rejoice. I'm going to praise thee. I'm going to be so happy and blessed, and I'm going to recognize my favorable situation. I'll be joyful in the Lord. Not joyful because of the destruction of my enemies, because of the downfall of someone that deserved to have downfall happen to them, but I'm going to rejoice because of salvation. He says, "It shall rejoice in his salvation." The thing that makes me so happy is the fact that I am saved. I've been spared. I have been protected by my God. Not that anything bad's happened to someone else, but that I have been given salvation. It's rejoicing in salvation. And so we today, as we stand in a position that's favorable in the sight of God, as we realize that we are in a position of being saved, we are being protected, we have reason then to give this same joy to God that David said he's going to give in the 9th verse. Further, he says in verse 10, "All my bones shall say, Lord, who is like unto thee?" All my bones means his entire self, his frame. The bones are the frame. So my whole body is going to be used. It's going to be put into the position of giving this praise to God. And they're going to say, "Lord, who is like unto thee?" What What being is like unto this great God? He is like no other. He is superior to all things. Who is like unto thee, which delivereth the poor from him that is too strong for him? Now the poor are those that are oppressed, those that are the godly people. They're portrayed in the Bible as being the poor. They're the ones who have need. Certainly they have spiritual need, and they recognize it. They are the poor in spirit. And thou deliverest the poor from him that is too strong for him. That is, he has obstacles, he has enemies, he has odds that are greater than he is, but yet God comes to their deliverance. Deliverest the poor from him that is too strong for him, yea, the poor and the needy from him that spoileth him. And the poor and the needy are synonymous. They are the ones that recognize the need for salvation, the need for spiritual help. They're the ones that turn to God. They're the ones that come with a contrite spirit and say, "Oh Lord, be merciful unto me, a sinner." And so God will rescue them. We must close the lesson at that point. Our time has expired. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.